You're listening to Tidings from Hazel Khan. The following program was the first in a series, Making Sense of a World in Crisis, originally broadcast in February 2009. It's been 70 years since the Irish playwright Sean O'Casey's play, Juno and the Paycock, ended with Captain Boyle lying flat on his back, drunkenly surveying his life and concluding, "Oh, the whole world's in a terrible state of chassis." 70 years later, we're still surveying our world in its terrible state of chaos as we watch banks sink, oceans flood, forests, homes, and jobs disappear, and war break out on fronts too numerous to count. The message that something uniquely big and bad is happening ricochets from us to our friends, to the blogosphere, to the mainstream media. The internet is alive with predictions that upcoming planetary alignments in the year 2012 will bring major earth-shattering events, either apocalypse or transformation, depending on where one sits. Visions of Armageddon dancing in their heads, some wring their hands proclaiming, "It's over, and we're done," while others, far fewer in number, proclaim visions of rebirth, renewal, and awakening. To enlarge and clarify my own perspective, I spoke with four leading thinkers, luminaries in their own fields, who think about such things full-time, speaking and writing and being generally influential. I wanted to know whether our lament is the same as those of the generations who've lamented before us, or has this particular constellation of events never come our way before? Perhaps we lack historical intelligence and grab onto the exceptionalism that makes us think it's all about us. On the other hand, perhaps something new and momentous really is taking place. How do you make sense of all this? I asked each of the thinkers. What is happening? Why is it happening? And how will it all end? John Dido Lurie, known in his community as Dido Roshi, is the founder and current abbot at Zen Mountain Monastery in Mount Tremper in upstate New York, and one of the most respected Zen Buddhist teachers in the United States. The monastery is known for the way it integrates art and Zen practice. Dido Roshi is the author of several books and an award-winning nature photographer. How do you make sense of what's happening on our planet, I asked him. What does all this change mean?
Well, I don't think the situation has really changed from the way it's been, except to become more intense and to affect a broader number of people than before. I mean, we've always had this business of fear, uncertainty, anger, disappointment have always been part of our existence. It's just that things have now become intensified because of the uncertainties associated with the financial situation worldwide and the challenges that that presents, and the uncertainty that it brings to individuals' lives, people losing their homes or in jeopardy of losing their jobs, lots of people, creates a kind of atmosphere of almost panic because of all of the uncertainty. And the only thing that Buddhism has ever had to offer is practice. Nothing has changed with regard to that. It means, first of all, first and foremost, trusting yourself. And this is the way I advise people. You know, the thing that's interesting to me is that at times such as this, the monastery fills up. More people come to the monastery. In times of war or pestilence or right through history, going all the way back into ancient times, whenever there were situations that threatened the existence of people, many of them would go to the monasteries to find a way out. And it's exactly what's happening for us at this time. And I thought for sure, because of the decrease in income for a lot of people, that we would see a big drop in the amount of attendance that would be happening here. Well, exactly the opposite has happened. It's doubled.
What are they look? Are they looking for refuge, or are they looking for answers, or comfort, or is that all the same thing? Maybe.
I think all of those things. They're not the same thing. They're quite different. Refuges, and comfort, and answers are kind of different, but the process for arriving at those things is primarily the same, and it has to do with their own introspection. You see, Buddhism is non-theistic, so it's not reaching out to a higher force to solve the problem. It's turning inward to solve the problem. That the problem and its source and its solution are all the same thing. And so through the process of meditation and introspection and really looking at the self and studying the self and understanding what it is that's causing the fear and anxiety is what begins to open the doors for resolving the difficulty. There are no quick answers that are going to come from Buddhism any more than there are going to be quick answers coming from anywhere else. The solution is precisely the same, whether you're a multimillionaire who has now lost everything, or someone who is a poor person who has never had anything. The way of dealing with the questions and the problems is precisely the same. You turn inward. Tendency is to regard who we are, the self, the nature of the self, as being a separate and distinct entity than the rest of the universe. We see the self as this bag of skin, everything encapsulated inside of it is me, and everything outside of it is the rest of the universe. Well, that's a fundamental delusion as far as Buddhism is concerned. In Buddhism, the inside and outside are regarded as the same thing. The self is no different than the rest of the universe. And what you do and what happens to you are the same thing. So that you can call karma. Buddhism is not going to solve the financial problem. That's going to remain. What it's going to deal with is how you function in a world that's so uncertain. It's not going to get you a new house. It's going to help you to adapt to whatever the circumstances are and learn to be satisfied and not give up and to keep going. So the solutions that Buddhism offer really have to do with developing a kind of self-confidence, a trust in the nature of things, a trust in oneself, rather than depending upon someone to come along and solve these problems for us.
I asked Daido Roshi whether the world would be different if everyone was a practicing Buddhist. Could some of these things have been prevented if there were more Buddhists in key places?
Well, it's hard to say. It's hard to answer a question like that, because just because a person is a Buddhist doesn't mean that they realize that they've transformed their consciousness, that they understand the unity of the universe. You can be a Buddhist and still be very deluded. I mean, there are, I'm sure, lots of Buddhists that were involved in all of these things that we're talking about. No one's exempt from that. Yeah, it would be a very different story in terms of war, for example. I mean, I don't think we would be in Iraq right now. I think we would be talking with our so-called enemies rather than fighting with them. We would be treating them, potential adversaries, as someone that can be communicated with. And I think that that's what's going to happen in this new administration. They seem to understand that.
Are they Buddhists? I've heard somewhere that Barack Obama is a Buddhist.
I don't think so. I don't know. But as far as I know, he's a Christian. I mean, that's what he's declared, and I accept that. But, I mean, Christianity has these things. The thing is that we don't pay attention to it is what the problem is. And we don't, you know, if we follow the teachings of Jesus or even Muhammad, really what he said, not what people, modern Muslims interpret as what he means, what he meant, I think it would be a very different world.
What is it about humans that creates things like war and financial disasters and environmental disasters and so on? What is it, from a Buddhist perspective, what are the, I don't know, the ingredients of a human being, maybe, that create these things?
I think it's delusion. I mean, it's a fundamental delusion that who we are is really separate and distinct from everybody else. So we treat people as something different than ourselves. We don't treat them as equals. We don't treat them as someone that deserves our respect and understanding and so on. So that gives rise to greed. It gives rise to anger. It gives rise to ignorance. And those things, greed, anger, and ignorance, what we call in Buddhism the three poisons, are the basis of a lot of pain and suffering. The other side of greed, anger, and ignorance, or greed, becomes compassion. It's the same elements, but the way they're working, once you remove the notion of a self, greed, where you want everything for yourself, the self disappears, then greed becomes compassion. You want what's good for everybody. Anger becomes wisdom, and ignorance becomes enlightenment. So the other side of greed, anger, and ignorance is compassion, wisdom, and enlightenment.
The solution is in our hands then, but we have to do it ourselves. No gurus, no teachers, no shortcuts. Just turning inward, practice, 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 and practice what you preach. Thank you. Peter Russell is interested in the deeper psychological issues behind the global crisis and in the ways consciousness can be developed to free up our mental potential. He's the author of many books, a popular speaker, and the author of a large eponymous website, peterrussell.com. Writing and speaking on topics as varied as consciousness, science, dolphins, sustainability, and usury. What does Peter Russell think is going on in our world today? Is it a genuine crisis, or is it better characterized as a historical cycle that appears every now and then?
It's coming to a head now, partly because the population has grown so rapidly, and also because our resources are now getting more limited, and we are beginning to create damaging effects on the rest of the planet. We've been doing this all along. We've been acting in a self-centered way, but we got away with it before. We could abuse our environment. We could abuse other people. You know, we could keep on growing our population locally without it causing major repercussions. But now all these things are coming to a head together. So I don't see there's any individual cause in the current times. There's lots of things you can see in the current times that are not right, you know, pollution of the environment, how we continue burning fossil fuels, etc. But these are all trends which have been going on for a long time. But also the population wants to have, more and more population wants to have cars and use energy in various ways and heat their houses or have air conditioning in the summer. So behind so much of our energy use is, again, this belief system that if I just had whatever it is, you know, central heating or a car or whatever, or use more energy at home or various things, I'll feel better for it. So it's that belief system which I think is driving our energy consumption, which is driving the CO2 production.
Could you say a bit more about what it is about us humans that drives this belief system?
So we become, in a sense, self-centered. We're looking the whole time, how can we take from the world or use the world or change the world or get the situation just right so that we're going to feel happier? So I think that's the basic belief system which drives our culture, which is now coming to a head in this crisis. It's been there all along, as I say, but we could get away with it in the past.
I know that in some of your books you talk about acceleration.
Yes.
Is that what's happening as well?
That's also happening. That's a good point, yes. The acceleration is also part of this. And that acceleration is caused by two things. Firstly, this drive to achieve more, to get more things, actually fuels technology to make things faster, more efficient. I mean, if you look at it, almost every technological invention we've had allows us to do more quicker, more easier, more efficiently. On top of that, there's a natural tendency of evolution to go faster. We can see this through the whole history of life on this planet. It took billions of years for simple cells to evolve, and then millions of years for more complex organisms, and mammals were faster still, and human beings have just been around for a million years, and civilization probably for just 10,000 years, and the Industrial Revolution was just 500 years ago, or not even that, 200 years ago, Renaissance 500 years ago. So evolution tends to speed up, and the reason is that each new development makes it easier for the next stage. And so the Industrial Revolution paved the way for, you know, what's happening now, the Information Revolution. We learned then how to build factories, do mass production, distribution, so that now we just plug computers into that. So there's this natural tendency for things to speed up. And that's also, as you rightly point out, part of the crisis. I mean, you could say, you know, what's behind the environmental crisis is one aspect of it is that we are changing the world far faster than the planet could adapt. I mean, take carbon dioxide, for example, burning fossil fuels and releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. If we were doing it at maybe 1/1,000th of the current rate, the planet could probably adapt. We're just doing it so fast that the planet cannot reabsorb that carbon dioxide.
Yeah, how do you see the financial meltdown? Does it fit in with what you're saying? Or is it a special case? Or?
It's so much of what people call, you know, business, I would paraphrase as, how can I deprive someone else of some of their material wealth and get it into my pocket? And I think what that's led to is the charging of interest, which, interestingly enough, has been banned by just about every religion in its own time. And it still is banned by
Islam, certainly.
Islam, yes. In the fundamentalist Islamic countries, the banks do not lend at interest. They lend on an equity basis. And it was banned by the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, it was Henry VIII who allowed the charging of interest again in Britain. When he broke from Rome, he not only legalized divorce, he legalized the charging of interest. And I think there's a sort of philosophical reason that you can't get something for nothing, and that interest is, because I have the money, I can get more money, and it ends up filtering the money more into the hands of the rich, out of the hands of the poor.
And so what is the rationale then behind not charging interest or banning interest?
Well, not charging interest is, why should one charge? If you make a loan to somebody, why should you make money out of making that loan? You know, it's so endemic in our culture that we think, well, it's completely natural to do so.
It's really difficult to even think about it, actually, that one would borrow money and not have to pay for it.
Yes. The problem with the charging of interest, I mean, it's basically, you know, it's greed behind the charging. The people who have money want to make more money.
Does the charging of interest lie at the heart of our problems as well as our system then? With the Bank of England and the Fed, we're down to virtually no interest already.
What it does is it leads us into a growth economy. To put it very simply, most of the money out in a culture is out on interest. Something like 9/10 of the money in circulation is borrowed money. And all that borrowed money, the interest has to be paid back on it. And so in order for the interest to be paid back, more wealth has got to be created in society. If you don't create, say the average interest was 3% a year on all the money that's out in circulation, the wealth of that country has got to increase by 3% that year. If it doesn't, then you get inflation, because the same amount of money needs to be repaid, but the actual wealth hasn't, real wealth hasn't increased. So that's why so many countries are wedded to this idea of growth. We've got to keep the economy growing at 3%, 4%, 5%, and it's seen that economic growth is a good thing. But that's behind that is the fact that there is that most of the money in circulation is out on interest. So That's one of the problems. I don't think, you know, the early spiritual people saw that as the reason. They saw it more as sort of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. But in our culture, I think it's one of the fundamental weaknesses behind our economic system.
So behind capitalism, in other words.
Yes. Yeah. It's all interlinked. It's all interlinked. I mean, the charging of interest fuels economic growth, and you can actually show that any economy that's based on interest charging must collapse eventually.
You can read more about usury on peterrussell.com. But Peter, you paint a very dire picture indeed. Does that make you into an incurable pessimist?
To start with, I'm realistic insofar as I see we are in an unprecedented crisis, and it's a really, really severe crisis. And if we continue going the way we're going. It's going to be very, very painful. It will be probably the collapse of Western civilization. I don't think it will be the end of humanity, but it's going to be a very, very painful collapse, and who knows where that's going to lead to if we keep going the way we're going. I also believe that human beings can change, and I think we can change in terms of our belief systems and attitudes. Although we hold on to them so firmly, I do believe we can actually change quite fast when given the opportunity.
So good things are happening, and we're all capable of changing, but how does it all come together? How do we move this thing forward? Are we waiting for the right leaders to emerge?
We can all be leaders to each other, you know, whether it's in our family, our community, or the wider society. I mean, I write books, you have a radio program. We put out ideas, and we put out ideas which we think are useful, they're going to help the world, and there's millions of us doing that. And so we are all leading each other and all learning from each other. And that, again, fuels the acceleration, because, you know, the more I learn, you know, I read something or pick up something on the web or someone's blog, and that fuels me, and that ends up in my writing or some talk or probably something I'm saying to you now, which goes on to someone else. And so we're, in a sense, leading each other. And then there are moments like, you know, I think with the election of Barack Obama, I think, you know, it's almost like the whole world rejoiced from that. I think the whole world had seen enough of the old way of doing things. And I think there was that recognition, here is something new, and people flocked to it. They wanted that, and really put their energy into making that happen.
You heard the late John Dido Lurie, founder of Zen Mountain Monastery, and writer and speaker Peter Russell, speaking in 2009 about their reactions to a world in crisis. This program was the first in a series Making Sense of a World in Crisis, originally broadcast in February 2009. You can hear Tidings on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport and streaming on WPKN.org. All Tidings programs are archived on hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.